Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know, catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location in a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
As Christians, we know that we are surrounded by principalities, powers, rulers of spiritual darkness. It's why the Apostle John warned us to test the spirits, because not all are from God. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Appreciate listening at VFTB.net or watching, if you're watching, YouTube.com/Derek Gilbert. The question is how we reach people who may not be in church, and especially young people who are allowing the internet into their heads 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They've all got cell phones that are connected to the internet, and most of us, parents and grandparents, don't take them away when they go to bed at night, so they are doing things and interacting with people we would never let past the front door. So, how do we reach them in a way that conveys the message that the spirit realm is real, that there are players on both sides, good and evil, and that they need to be very careful about the side they choose and how they interact with that realm? Our guest is making that her mission through the use of words. She is an author. She's a publisher as well. Her website is larispress.com, and I'll ask for a correction on my pronunciation there in a minute. But the writer of a number of books, author of a number of books, and her fiction work specifically aimed at younger readers. Her nonfiction book, Free to Be, Defeating Insecurity, Transforming Relationships, Building Character, a book for preschoolers and young children, The Faithful Prince, and the first book for young adult readers in a series that looks very interesting. The series called Between Realities, Book One, is Confronting the Darkness, published in May of 2016. We are proud to welcome to the program for the first time author Sarah Tun. Sarah, it's a pleasure to meet you.
It is a privilege to be here, Derek. Thank you so much for inviting me on.
Well, as we discussed before hitting the record button here, we don't know exactly where this conversation is going to go, but and why I keep saying conversation. But yeah, you're approaching this topic in the same way that Sharon and I have been trying to approach it for about the last 11 years, and using fiction as a means to open the door. And Sharon is writing more adult supernatural fiction, X-Files meets, Christian worldview. I did one that was a science fiction fantasy mashup aimed at younger readers called Iron Dragons. Confronting the Darkness, your protagonist is a 10-year-old girl named Jasper. And you got my attention when you described it as, something meets Wrinkle in Time. Madeline Lingle. Yes.
Yes. C.S. Lewis meets C.S. Lewis. Madeline Lingle.
Yeah.
C.S. Lewis, there's a little bit of a younger aspect or a younger version of Screwtape Letters and a bit of a flavor of the Narnia series. So there's fantasy, it's sci-fi fantasy, but some people, including yourself, remember A Wrinkle in Time.
It used to be on
the prospectus for schools, sci-fi for sort of 10 plus. And yes, the idea of the book began a long time ago. The most important aspect to convey is that, you know, if you think of young people, any of us, but particularly young people reading books, they're by themselves. There is no distraction, and they get an opportunity to use their own imaginations. Nothing's filtered in, and they're not bombarded. Even if they're reading on a Kindle or whatever, they're just reading a book. And so it's them, their eyes, their imaginations. And my aim is to grab hold of children before they become cynical, before they refuse to recognize God. Romans 1 talks about our knowledge of God. We know God exists. I think that up until about the age of 2, they are seeing angels. And I don't think there's a coincidence people say the terrible 2s. I think that's when the battle really starts. But the main impetus for what I write is to encourage people to be everything God's created them to be. And so I want to make my influence to touch youth so that they can be who God created them to be, not who the media has created them to be, huh. Not who the internet tells them who they're supposed to be, and so on and so forth. Hmm. So through a book, they have that intimacy where they can be real with themselves. And so that's the aim. Yeah.
When I was the age of your protagonist, I was all about books. I went through everything I could get my hands on in the school library, the local library branch in Chicago, and read some things that were beyond my years. But Madeline L'Engle and other books like that opened up my imagination were very influential. I soon gravitated toward hard science fiction, and of course that had a very strong influence on me as well, and it was not a Christian influence. But thankfully, I've moved beyond that. Still have a love for hard science fiction, but I understand now that you can meld that with Christian faith, which is something I didn't believe until about 15 years ago. When I wrote my novel, The God Conspiracy, which is more of a conspiracy-type thriller with a supernatural flavor to it, one of my characters was a boy about the age of Jasper. And the challenge I had was when writing point of view for the character was trying to remember what it was like to see the world as a 10-year-old. Yes. And make that believable. I think authors struggle with that. I often see characters in books and on TV at that age who are written with dialogue that's way beyond their years. How did you go about putting yourself into the mind of Jasper as the protagonist of this novel, this story?
Well, part of the way it's written, there are different dimensions to the story. It's a mix of sci-fi and fantasy. The mm-hmm. fantasy aspect is the supernatural aspect, angels and demons, but we don't talk about angels and demons. God's mentioned once in the book, but if somebody was to pick it off the shelf, it's not obviously a Christian book, although all the values of Christianity are there.
Right.
So there's that aspect, and there's the supernatural aspect where the father of the child, Jasper, is a scientist. The story takes place in the 60s when that is the explosion of cynicism, exploration. Neil Armstrong landed on the moon in 69. People are asking questions, social upheaval, all kinds of stuff going on. And so this girl, she's a little bit precocious, but she, in order to prevent her sounding older than her years, she's bright, but she has very low self-esteem. She thinks that she's the dummy of the family because A, she's the youngest and she's not a scientist. And she doesn't realize that actually she is incredibly imaginative. And in fact, people think she's imagining things when various things, experiences she has that are supernatural, she doesn't realize they're supernatural. So what I did was I introduced the spiritual world that she's completely oblivious to, which allowed me to speak in a way that it's for 12 plus, so it's not too sophisticated language, but allowed me to speak more beyond a 10-year-old's mm-hmm. scope. But the main action of the story, or there's multi dimensions, but the dimension that she's in, it's the 10-year-old telling. Well, it's a third person, but it's from a 10-year-old's point of view.
Right, right.
And she only has one other person with her, which is an old man, and so he speaks to her not in a patronizing way, but he is speaking to a 10-year-old. So the way around it is who else is involved in the story, and having kind of a two-tier structure where there's the supernatural that the reader knows about, but it isn't till very deep in the story that she has any inkling of what's going on.
Hmm.
And that way we can see it. It's kind of, it's a counterpoint to the Harry Potter sort of thing, where instead of, you've got a lot of darkness that's attractive and interesting, but good versus evil from that perspective. You still have good versus evil, but it's, without it being threatening to a 10 or 12-year-old, it's quite truthful to my understanding of the spiritual realm and what happens, what goes on. This is where the Screwtape Letters is kind of reminiscent. What goes on in our minds? Joyce Meyer wrote a book, Battlefield of the Mind, and it is a battlefield, and we know that as adults. I want kids to recognize it as well. That is, that there are things competing for our attention. Mm-hmm. And if you suddenly realize, oh, that's not really my thought, I'm not really wanting to do that horrible thing, it doesn't mean you're not giving ownership or responsibility, but it helps them to understand that there are competing forces,
right,
outside of ourselves that are competing for our attention, competing for our investment.
Loyalty.
And so I hope that answers the question. The two-tier structure allows the child to sound like a child, but there are other aspects to the story, so that a 15-year-old is still interested. And I have had a lot of adults read it, because I suppose I'm marketing particularly to mums and grandmas who want their kids to read stories that are interesting and well written, but that aren't so heavy and dark. Mm-hmm. and what I would say is distasteful, you know, just oppressive. Mm-hmm. So trying to appeal, and therefore I've had a lot of older people, particularly women, review and say that it is accomplishing that. It is tapping into that childlike innocence mixed with the lack of self-esteem that people, when they're going through puberty, are experiencing, and they are down on themselves and they look elsewhere for things. And instead, no, what is inside you? Who are you? What's inside you? And you know what? There's a lot of good stuff going on. Mm.
The premise of the book, and I'm looking at the description at your website here, Larus Press, ALRUSPress.com, begins with Jasper waking up in a world of utter silence and total isolation, which for a child, especially one of low self-esteem, has to be absolutely horrifying, terrifying. From that point, then, how do you, how does the character interact with this world of shadows? Do they try to terrify her or scare her initially, or is it a little more alluring and seductive in trying to draw her in through promises?
No, what it is that the way she experiences this is that although it's scary, because there's no sound around her. Mm-hmm. And then she discovers nobody is around her. There are angels, and what, for lack of a better, you know, way of putting it, there are angels protecting her. And so throughout the experience, you get the sense that she is safe. But that would be boring, right?
Right, right.
So then introduce the demonic. She's completely unaware, and they just about grab her. And there's this idea that if they make contact, then she's extremely vulnerable. Mm. So that keeps the suspense going. But what happens is we see that very soon that the angels and the demonic are battling for this person. And we don't know what's going to happen, but we're drawn in without being... What was tricky was not making it boring, not too safe, but not too scary, because I'm wanting to appeal to 12-year-olds, right?
Right.
Not to adults, and you don't want to scare them too much. So that was a bit tricky. But I think that is really what's happening. So in a sense, we are, and children before the age of responsibility, there is a certain level of protection. Now we can go into the theology, and if you're raised in a Christian home and you're not raised, you know, but that's not what we're here for. But it's to give the sense of what is happening beyond what we can see. There is a lot happening beyond what we can see. and how the world operates completely oblivious to it, but deep inside, you know that there's more than what we can see. Mm-hmm. And if a child finishes the book just knowing that much, and there's lots more, but just knowing that much, it keeps that open. It keeps that door open, away from cynicism. Oh, there's not that, you know, there was a big bang, and when we're dead, we're dead, and we're just animals, and all the other tapes that are being youth are being subjected to.
Yeah, the naturalistic bias, the scientism that is pushed on us in public school, especially. It's funny how I catch myself in that sort of bias even today, which is based on the premise that if we humans with our limited perceptions can't see, measure, and quantify something, it doesn't exist. And of course, that is based on the assumption that we can perceive, quantify, measure everything, which by definition would make us as gods. The story, Wrinkle in Time, there were some scenes in there that scared me. The dinner scene, especially, where Charles suddenly flips and, you know, he thinks that he's having this wonderful meal where before, just moments before, it tasted like sand. For some reason, that one scene in that book just stuck with me. The interaction with the supernatural realm is something we only know a limited amount about. I mean, the Bible tells us a little bit about the actions, the workings of angels and demons. And I know this is something Sharon is working through now as she writes a series of novels that involve the actions of the spirit realm influencing our natural world. What kind of research did you do in order to create a compelling story, one that will engage and excite the readers without going too far into speculation beyond what we know from the Bible?
Well, I've been a believer for about 30 years. I'm not a theologian, but I have studied theology. I've read sort of the New Testament probably half a dozen times, mm-hmm. and the whole Bible three times at least. So I'm fairly well versed in the Bible. I'm spirit-filled, and so I've got certain gifts that allow me to have a discernment of things in the spirit world. So it's a lot from the spiritual dimension. Mm-hmm. A lot of it has been my walk with God, which, you know, you can't, it's a testimony, and that's what we all stand on when we witness Christ, right? It's Christ in me. So in that regard, there's that aspect. Also, you know, I live in fellowship with believers, so I've had loads of conversations both regarding but extraneous to the book. So as that aspect of the story unfolded, of course it's a novel, it's fiction, but it's taking my understanding and my experience and my knowledge of the Bible and not veering away from that. Mm-hmm. Now, there are lots of different theological views about the gifts of the Spirit and all these various things. And so I am one Pentecostal in preference, but knows the word very well and raised traditionally. From the scientific aspect, I'm a creative person more than a scientist. Mm-hmm. So I have some members of my family who are, and my husband's family who are scientists, and one nephew is a graduate of, has his master's at Oxford in physical science. So we had some conversation, and I said, is this viable? Is that viable? You know, to make sure that scientifically it has some weight. He is not a believer. And it was interesting having conversation. He said, yeah, that's viable. Yeah, And, you know, so there's a lot of stuff we haven't talked much about, you and I, but about the stars and the expanding universe, which is in the 60s that they start having these kinds of questions. So parallel in the story is the father trying to prove the universe is expanding, and the daughter trying to discover that she has something to offer this family because she doesn't fit in. And what happens is she proves that the universe is expanding.
Oh, cool.
So it's a, yeah. So I did have some people read the book that were not believers and that were sci-fi buffs. And one guy said, initially, I thought, no, this isn't viable. By the time I got to the end, I thought, yeah, I can suspend suspend my disbelief enough to say, yeah, this is conceivable. So, and I thought that was high praise indeed from somebody who's an atheist.
yeah.
So it was a mix of my own journey in terms of understanding the spiritual aspects with some research in terms of the science fiction. And I'm old enough to remember the 60s. I was a child, but so, you know, it's a marriage of who I am and what God's put in me with a bit of research and a whole lot of imagination. And really the first draft, fourth or fifth draft, the very first draft, a lot of it was on my knees, just saying, okay, Lord, what happens next? Where do I go from here? Not knowing whether it's a children's book, an adult's book, what, you know, not really knowing where we were going. And it's morphed tremendously.
That's an interesting approach and a really good response. And I think the correct response in terms of trying to work through it. I mean, there are obviously things that we don't know because the Bible only tells us what we need to know about the spirit realm, which is that we shouldn't seek contact with it because not everything that's in there is friendly to us. And we're not necessarily smart enough to discern which or which unless we, you know.
Absolutely. And we're not even really meant to be chatting with angels either. I mean,
right.
If one shows up in your bedroom and says, well, he might be the real thing or he might be satanic because we have a whole world religion
right.
Based on a misunderstanding of an angel. So,
right.
Yeah. So it's not in any way seeking that. The only encounter, supernatural encounter that she has is with, there is, we come to recognize two characters. If you're an adult, certainly an adult believer, Jesus is in the story and there is an angel. But if you look at, for those that might be thinking, ooh, I don't know, this sounds dodgy. If you think about Abraham and him hosting people.
Right.
And, you know, and Jesus saying, you know, if you give a cup of water to a stranger, who knows who that stranger is.
Right.
The
book of Hebrews says the same thing. By so doing, we entertain angels unawares. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. So it's not asking people to try to explore the supernatural, but rather be aware. And it'd be interesting to know adult feedback for those of you who read Confronting the Darkness. What do you take as a from the supernatural? But if anybody's interested, it's on Amazon and the reviews are all there. And I haven't had anybody say that I'm trying to lead people astray. So,
well, I'll be adding this to my Kindle. In fact, my Kindle's right down here as I am talking with you, and I'll be pushing the order Kindle button before the end of the conversation here. Because again, I think that there is a real need for this. Certainly statistically, we know that if children aren't committed to Jesus Christ by the age of 18, the statistics show that it's unlikely in the extreme that they will do so in their adult lives. And that's generally going to require some sort of traumatic experience to force them to stop and reconsider the path that they're on. Mm-hmm. And so we as parents and grandparents have a responsibility to try to bring them in now. And sadly, you know, speaking as a man, most of my colleagues out there and friends out there have not been standing up and performing their due diligence as spiritual heads of their households. And I say this as one who didn't really understand that was my role until I was in my mid-30s. So this
one thing I will say is that the devil or the deceiver appears in the story. And what the child is faced with is, do I go with what looks good, or do I know what, or do I go with what I know is good? Mm-hmm. And it's very important. And there's even the element of, you know, you hear about Facebook and all the various media. And I think there's something called Yellow now, and it's for kids, and there's no screening, and you have no idea who. And so there's a moment where she's really drawn to somebody who is absolutely evil. And the reader knows that, the reader discovers, mm-hmm. I think a reader will recognize the evil before the child does. And that's very interesting, because that is meant to help people discern. And again, I think that discernment, it's that hunch. And if you indoctrinate people to only go so deep because of technology and things, you kill that discernment. And that discernment is as powerful, whether it's, you consider it spiritual or just that fight or flight reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not a good situation. And we, even unwittingly as parents, we can confuse that ability by saying, oh, so-and-so is my friend, and say hello and be polite and all that, when actually the child senses, no, there's something not right.
Yeah.
That we don't sense, because we don't, you know, we just don't see that person as a child would see.
Yeah.
And so it's, I guess I'm just trying to solve a child's problem in the main, in one series, which you can't do. But all you can do is take what you know, put it out there in as well written a format as you can, and say, there go I, you know, God, go with me. And there it is. And just pray that lots and lots, your series and your wife's series and mine and thousands of other authors, that people will grab hold of these things and get the nuggets that they need.
Yeah. And you anticipated a question, which was, to go a little deeper into how evil is portrayed in the book. And we know from the Bible that even Satan can appear as an angel of light. So that is one of the interesting things about the way Hollywood typically chooses to portray evil, which is spewing pea soup and green and fangs and things. And my contention is, if the enemy chose to reveal himself that way to most of us, he would literally scare the out of us, and it would be sort of self-defeating. Evil's going to be much more devious and attractive to that. Yes, exactly. And that was the basis of conversations we had on Skywatch TV and also on this program back over the summer with Opal Singleton, who has a ministry called MillionKids.org, which is named for the rough number of children who are being trafficked around the United States at any given time. And often they are pulled into it because of social media apps like the one you described, social apps that I'd never heard of. And, you know, I'm pretty aware. Sharon and I met in 1997 over the internet, back when only 20% of Americans actually knew what the internet was. So we're early adopters into this technology. Most of us, parents, grandparents, don't have any clue about what our kids are and who's contacting our children through social media these days. But not to deviate too far from the point here. Let me ask you then about how your background has influenced or influenced the writing of Jasper and her struggles. I note that, as we mentioned at the beginning of the program, you have a nonfiction book called Free to Be, Defeating Insecurity, Transforming Relationships, Building Character. How has your walk, your upbringing, your struggles shaped the way you saw the world through the eyes of Jasper in confronting the darkness?
I think that the sorts of experiences, I came from a secure, stable background on the surface, but my family relationship wasn't particularly good. Mm. The main thing was that I was bullied as a child, things like that. So I grew up feeling quite insecure for any number of reasons. And as a result, when I came to the Lord, I was saved and I trusted him, but I wasn't walking in the freedom, in the life, in the joy, in the success. I don't mean monetary success. I mean the fullness that life, you know, I come to give you life and to have it more abundantly. And mm-hmm. I wasn't walking in that. Eventually I realized I was living with a cloud over my head. And it's not until you know there's a cloud there, that not everybody else has a cloud, that you don't, not everybody walks around feeling insecure, feeling doubtful, feeling oppressed, that that's not how we're meant to live. It's not until you realize the cloud's there that you think, actually, this cloud shouldn't be here. And my theology didn't match with how I was living. Mm-hmm. And so I learned, I had some counseling, I had some deliverance, I had some deep teaching and my own probing of the Bible, my own relationship with Jesus. Through all those things, I got rid of the oppression, I got rid of the cloud, I got rid of the insecurity. But when the caricature of Jasper was developed, there's a lot of the 10-year-old child that was me. The insecurity, the feeling like she didn't belong in the family. And I think there are a lot of people, particularly women, you know, you hear story. Well, was that maybe I was adopted because I don't fit, you know, that sort of scenario. And it isn't even in certainly in Jasper's case, it isn't even the parents' fault, which I think becomes evident. It's not a book about bashing parents in inefficiencies or imperfections, but rather the child's perception. And because she does see things differently, she sees when people don't get her a point of view, they think that she thinks they're being critical, that sort of thing. So insecurity isn't only how we're treated or what we experience, but it's also how we receive that experience. It's just like now they have those comfort rooms in some of these universities and they, and, you know, where people have said, oh, we can't have certain guest speakers because it's too difficult to deal with. It's too contentious. Well, that is just not allowing somebody to overcome, allowing somebody to the freedom to differ with someone else, that kind of thing. So it's the difference. It's a different perspective. We can walk around thinking that we're victims, or we can walk around thinking that we're overcomers. And it's the same person. It's just your perception of what your experiences are. My personal theology is God is sovereign, and everything I've experienced, good, bad, and in between, he knew it was going to happen, but it's molded and shaped me. So the bullying, for example, I learned compassion. I was insensitive. I was a loud extrovert, very cheery, happy little kid. After the bullying, I was insecure, but also I would never be unkind to somebody, not on purpose. I learned compassion, and that was the first hard knock lesson. But I went from being thick-skinned maybe or oblivious to thin-skinned. Why did I have to go through that? The Lord knows. And I know now as an adult that although that was difficult, I can see how the lack of sensitivity I might not even have come to the Lord, you know, just so oblivious. In terms of family differences, you know, you're put in a family to grow and to prosper, and my needs, you know, were met. We just didn't have good family dynamics. You know, we'll leave it at that and say that happens sometimes, right. A lot of times, but it makes you who you are. And so I suppose there's a little bit of a happy ending biographical aspect to this story, because without giving the whole series away or anything, by the end of the book, Jasper recognizes that her family loves her. If that speaks to teenagers that think, oh, my parents don't know anything, my parents don't care, well, actually, it's the perception.
Right.
And sometimes it's just the perception, and actually you need to just receive what they have to offer.
Yeah.
You know?
I can relate to that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a teacher of high school for a number of years, and I absolutely adore teenagers. And I think I'm an anomaly. Well, and I may change my mind in 3 years, you know, and decide, oh, now I get why people don't like teenagers. But I do really like them. I really get them. I think that, what did I say on the back of my book? I'll tell you what I said on the back of the book. Her ideas come from imagination and a love for people. She particularly adores teens and empathizes with them for the challenges, temptations, and ambitions they face with so much passion for life and so little experience of it.
That's well put.
And that's my take. You know, they don't know anything, but they act like they do.
Right.
And they are 100% sincere. And that's why I love them.
Yeah. It's funny because our daughter, who's now 26, had thought that she was going to be an English teacher when she completed her schooling. This was during high school. And after talking to a couple of her teachers, she changed her mind because she decided that as a teenager, she didn't like teenagers. Which is too bad because she would have been a really good one. She has a real love for literature, and she did some writing when she was in her teens that was way beyond her years and really good. But she's found a different calling, and she's really good at that too. Maybe she'll come back to that someday.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, I never did a degree in English. I shied away from it, and years on, I'm writing books and without ever having studied it. I did have to go back and encounter a few professors here and there. But what I found, I did a drama degree and I steered away from plays because I thought, well, if I write a play and it's bad, I've got no excuse. But if I write a book, I've never studied, so I'm okay.
You have an excuse to fall back on. Well, I did the next best thing. My degree's in econ, and I just married a woman who's got a minor in English. So she's the one who can tell me that I can't diagram a sentence, but she can tell me when things are not where they're supposed to be, not in the right order. So why then is it this love of teenagers that led you to write this series, the Between Realities series, and aim it at that age group? And why did you choose that age group instead of aiming your fiction at people of, you know, our age, adult age?
I think when I started the book, as I said, the first draft was on my knees. And as I started the book, I didn't know it was for young people. And it was only the last couple of drafts, I think there were about five drafts, the last couple of drafts when I realized, actually, this is for teenagers. And I suddenly thought, well, of course it's for teenagers because I love teenagers. And who do I know best? Mm-hmm. Teenagers.
Yeah.
But God often does that. You know, I remember when I was thinking of becoming a teacher, or I was in university and thinking, well, what am I going to do with my life? And it, you know, had lots of ideas. And when I settled on teaching, I thought, well, of course, why wouldn't I? I used to tutor in high school, and the kids, my peers would all come to me and say, could I help? It's funny how sometimes the obvious, we miss the obvious for the longest time. Mm-hmm. And so I think I aimed it at teenagers because that's what I love most in terms of age group and understand most. I think I understand teenagers maybe better than I understand my peers. And so because of that love, God eventually steered me that way, but it was unconscious. It was completely unconscious.
Hmm. Before we run out of time here, I want to ask about the book that you wrote for preschoolers and young children, The Faithful Prince. This is a little different, and this is a full color illustrated book. What was it that inspired the book, The Faithful Prince?
My 7-month-old son.
Ah, that will do it.
Yeah.
They have a tendency of reframing your worldview, don't they?
It's a complete in-your-face worship story for little toddlers, for parents to teach their kids, how do you worship God? And how do you know God's real?
Mm-hmm.
And all that stuff, all that good stuff, but from a frame of reference for little kids.
Hmm. It was... our daughter that kind of got me focused. I mentioned, you know, the mid-30s being about the time when I finally realized what I was supposed to be doing. It was one night when the Holy Spirit kind of whispered in my ear, and not that I heard anything audible, but I don't take credit for this epiphany, suddenly realizing that I didn't know how to explain to our daughter, who was 6 at the time, the difference between right and wrong, because I didn't know why I believed certain things were right and certain things were wrong. And it occurred to me that because I said so is not a good enough answer. So that led me into studying apologetics. So where?
But that's fantastic. That's fantastic.
Well,
the power of children, and you often hear stories of people who are, they have addictions or they have issues or whatever, and it's the questions of their children that suddenly wake them up and change them.
Yeah,
which is fantastic.
One of the best answers to a question, an interview question I've ever heard, was when I heard the conservative columnist Cal Thomas interviewing Johnny Cash, and he asked him, "What do you want on your headstone, your memorial marker when you die?" And Johnny Cash replied, "He was a good daddy."
Brilliant.
And
that's fantastic. Yeah. Man. Yeah. I wrote a poem a while back, a long while back when my son was an infant, and there's a line in it. To raise you to know the King of Light. So, you know, the poem is about, you know, what do I want to do with my life? And then I look at you and I think, what is my job? To raise you to know the King of Light. And I don't memorize my work, so I couldn't quote the whole thing. But so often I'm looking at him and we're talking about something, and in the back of my mind, I raise you to know the King of Light.
Hmm.
So I understand Johnny Cash's sentiment. Yeah.
And he certainly had his share of struggles and temptations as well.
But he won in the end.
He did. Amen.
Yeah.
So where does Jasper go from here? How many books do you envision in the series? And as she ages, how will her challenges and temptations change?
Yes. I've only, in my mind, clarified the second book, which is called The Three Stones.
Hmm.
I do know that I think that there are seven books. And I believe that the next book is not so very far in the future, maybe 6 months. So she's still 10, 11 years old. But she'll probably remain a child, because I've got another series untitled about teenagers and proper teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about the main character is a girl who dances. And it's much more Christian. It's much more obviously Christian because she's a committed Christian. But as you mentioned, you know, your conversation with your daughter when she was six, this girl is challenged. Well, why do I believe in what I believe? Why do I know this is right? And it mixes end times. And what's interesting, if there are any authors listening, nothing is ever wasted.
Mm-hmm.
In this book, I've only written the first draft, but in this book, there are two other books that I started to write and never finished because they didn't go anywhere. And they're in this book. There's Alia, you know, when the Jewish people go back home, there's a whole strand of that. And so that's more the teenage thing. Whether Jasper, to answer your question fully, whether Jasper goes into her teens, probably not. Probably the series will end by the time she's about 12 or 13. But the teenage years are caught up with another girl. Hmm. And I've only written one draft, and it was 6 months ago. I can't remember her name.
I know how that goes. I was trying to remember the name of my young character, and I couldn't remember. I finally did it. But it was like, oh, my gosh, that was like 10 years ago, and I don't remember his name.
Authors probably remember their plot lines in depth. And every character and every nuance for everything, but I don't.
There's only so much space in here, and every now and then you have to clear the cache. So gone, but I know where to find it again. So at least I don't have to try to worry about memorizing it. Well, there's a lot of water under the bridge between then and now, and a lot of things change in life, and hopefully that these books getting into the hands of young people today, that by the time they're our age, they will have had some different choices along the way, and it won't take unexpected life changes to motivate them to seriously consider what it is they believe and how they can know that the Bible is true.
Now, there's another aspect to all of this. You know, the Lord says, don't make plans one day at a time, that sort of thing.
Right.
And time is short. We haven't talked about one of the impetuses for our writing. You know, both of us is you know, time is short and yes. things are hastening quickly on to who knows where.
Right.
I think my worldview is that when things change, when the kingdom of God comes down to earth, things will be very different. And whether it's our children or our grandchildren, the world will be a completely different place and their calling will be completely different. I don't think it's going to end. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be transformed.
Right.
And who knows what that means? But from my perspective, I think it's going to be positive. Ultimately, we know who wins.
Right.
So a part of me just wants to get on and get the books written. But there's another part of me that's learned, no, go with the pace God gives, because he knows the beginning from the end. Mm-hmm. And there's so much we can do nowadays that's good, but it's much more important to do what's God, and the rest takes care of itself.
Amen to that. Sarah Tunn is the author of the Between Reality series. Book one is Confronting the Darkness. There will be future books in the series, God willing. Also, the book Free to Be, Defeating Insecurity, Transforming Relationships, Building Character, and a book for young uns, as they say here in the Ozarks. The Faithful Prince, Preschoolers, Young Children, the Target for the Faithful Prince. By the way, for those of you who've known me for a while, I don't mean young uns as any kind of derogatory remark about people who live in the Ozarks. I've got a Chicago bias that I have to work to overcome a lot. And I did find out that you uns is actually something that folks south of Interstate 80 will say. And so I've learned that that's just how folks talk. And so forgive me for making it sound like a derogatory remark there.
Anyway. I don't think so at all. No, they're just little guys.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the thing that I've learned also about myself, even after growing up in the city of Chicago, is that I am much happier being from there than in there. And we live now in an area where the county seat has got 800 people. The town we work in has got 1,400 people. And where Sharon and I live, our nearest neighbors are cattle, chickens and coyotes. So, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Sarah, where is the best place for people to find copies of Confronting the Darkness?
You can either go to Larus Press, L-A-R-U-S Press, which is my website, or you can go directly to Amazon. If you just type in the title, Confronting the Darkness, my name's Sarah Tunn, S-A-R-A-H-T-U-N, and the book will pop up. And anything else, Amazon, Sarah Tunn, author, all the books will pop up.
All right.
So love to see you on my website. Love folks to sign up for the newsletter, because my whole modus operandi is to encourage people to prepare for God's call.
Amen to that. Sarah Tunn, again, the author, Confronting the Darkness, book one of Between Realities. A pleasure getting to know you, and look forward to staying in touch and finding out what happens next in the world of in the life of Jasper.
Amen to that. And for your books as well, all the best.
To find out more about Sarah Tunn and her books, check the links in the show notes. You'll find them both at the audio podcast website, which is vftb.net. That's what we call your basic acronym, View from the Bunker, vftb.net. And if you're watching this on YouTube, and we thank you for subscribing, that's youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. You'll find links there as well to her website, laruspress.com, and links to where you can find the book, Confronting the Darkness, book one of the Between Realities series. And I look forward to reading that as soon as I have time. I'm in the process of trying to write my own, promised the manuscript to Tom Horn by the end of December for the book, The Great Inception, Satan's Psyops from Eden to Armageddon. That's the working title. And the plan, if all goes well, is to have this out in time for the spring. So your prayers for clarity of thought and word are greatly appreciated as we work to get this finished up. Essentially, it's a look at how the supernatural war between God and the gods, especially for control of holy mountains, plays out in the Bible. Did you know that God actually attacked and conquered Mount Hermon? It's in there. That and more coming up in that book. And we'll have a number of programs on that on Skywatch TV and maybe even here on A View from the Bunker as we get toward March. This will be my first nonfiction book. I've contributed chapters to a number of anthologies that are out there, but this will be the first full-length book. And in fact, t- timing on it, again, if all goes well, will be just about perfect because it should be out just in time for the Hear the Watchmen conference in Dallas on March 31st through April 2nd. Sharon and I will be speaking there along with two of our colleagues from here at Skywatch TV, Josh Peck and Jake Rahutsky. So we'll be traveling down there and bringing box loads of books and whatnot to the Hear the Watchmen conference. For complete information, there is a link at the website, vftb.net, or you can go to hearthewatchmen.com and click the link there to get your registration. Your early registration, by the way, saves you some money. There is a discount involved in that if you take advantage of it during the month of December. So get registered now, and then we pray that we will see you in the spring in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. The program I did with Gans Shimura last week was followed by a program on Skywatch TV with Josh Peck and Jake Rahutsky about the Pizzagate scandal. And I might use the word so-called scandal, because at this point, as of this recording, still have not seen hard evidence that connects any of this disturbing imagery around the Comet Ping Pong restaurant to anything firm in the way of criminal activity. And we received, or I received, a number of emails after these programs that basically were of two categories. One was a thank you for addressing the issue. But second was from several women who themselves were victims of abuse. And that is the tragedy of this, that in many of these cases, the allegations are never put before a grand jury because the victims who dare to speak out aren't believed. And I just wanted to clarify that I, nor any of the gentlemen I was speaking with, Gans Shimura, Jake Rahutsky, Josh Peck, none of us were saying that we don't believe that this goes on, that the abuse of children for sexual purposes is an imaginary thing. We do believe it, which is why we even talk about it and bring it up. In fact, as we pointed out on Skywatch TV, the Monday report from this past week, it's a big part of what we do on Skywatch TV, why we do what we do. We take some criticism at Skywatch TV for promoting books, DVDs, conferences, and so forth. But the reason we do that is to raise the funds to support Whispering Ponies Ranch. The purpose of Whispering Ponies Ranch is not for Nita Horn to just have fun playing with little horsies. It is to provide a facility using these animals as therapy animals to begin to heal children who are coming out of horrifying situations, whether it's sexual abuse, parental neglect, there are any number of other situations where children wind up in foster care. And through the partnership with Royal Family Kids, and you'll find them online at rfk.org, facilities like Whispering Ponies Ranch are used to begin to build a bond of trust to children who have been so emotionally and spiritually scarred that they don't want to let anyone in. It's hard to share the gospel of Jesus Christ with somebody who is so closed off that they won't listen to anything you have to say. And beyond that, they're at much greater risk for eventual incarceration and early death. And of course, to repeat this cycle of abuse, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse on the next generation. But Royal Family Kids works to show them a different model of family, that there are loving bonds between people, people that they can trust. But the first step is getting them to open up. And that's where the therapy animals come in. And that's where Whispering Ponies Ranch comes in. Nita is training these horses, and horses are being gifted to other facilities that are using them as therapy animals. The reason we do what we do on Skywatch TV, and the reason we promote books and conferences and DVDs, is to support the ranch and support it so well that Royal Family Kids doesn't have to pay a cent to bring the children to those therapy animals. That's why we do what we do, and that's why we talk about this topic. Our only point in questioning the narrative of hashtag Pizzagate is to suggest that it's not helpful to victims who have suffered abuse to make baseless accusations, or accusations at least without enough evidence to begin a police investigation. And to this point, the police have said there is no grounds for an investigation of the owner or the customers of Comet Ping Pong. Yes, the artwork displayed there is sometimes disturbing. Some of the people connected to the owner have very disturbing tastes in art, in particular Tony Podesta, the brother of John Podesta, Hillary Clinton's campaign chair. We understand that. We get that. But much of what is being thrown around is based on interpretations of certain words from emails that were divulged by WikiLeaks, emails from John Podesta's Gmail account. And the interpretation of those code words is open to question. I haven't seen a law enforcement source confirm that those words mean what some researchers say that they mean. And until then, we're throwing accusations around without solid evidence. My concern is that doing this might lead the major media, which has already turned fake news into an internet meme, that they will then take the very real phenomenon of child sexual abuse and debunk it in the way that they debunked satanic ritual abuse back in the late 80s, early 90s. Throwing around accusations without firm evidence gives them ammunition to claim that this is just another satanic panic. And that doesn't help the victims. So, we've been talking about it on this program and on PID Radio since 2005. We've done programs back in the early days, and I've done a number of interviews with people who've researched this, researched cases like the Franklin Credit Union cover-up, the Finders cult scandal from Washington, D.C., an investigation into the Finders shut down by the State Department on the grounds of national security, I point out, the Franklin Credit Union scandal involving a very well-connected homosexual pimp who was able to get 15-year-old rent boys a tours of the White House late at night during a Republican presidential administration, I add. So this goes on, and we know that Washington, D.C. has these vile creatures swimming in those dark waters. I have no question about that. There is no question in my mind. But before we start accusing specific people of specific things, let's have evidence. We do know, for example, that the former Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, a Republican from Illinois, was recently charged by the FBI with essentially paying hush money to a young man that he abused years ago. And we know that Mr. Hastert, Speaker Hastert, is friends with John and Tony Podesta. In fact, Hastert's son worked for the Podesta's lobbying firm. So we've got a connection there, but all that proves is that John and Tony Podesta are friends with Dennis Hastert. It doesn't prove any specific activity on their part, but that at least is concrete information. I'm not saying we should shut it down. Let's pull up the threads, but let's just be a little more cautious about throwing around accusations. Because again, it gives the major media, which has a vested interest in preserving the status quo, keeping things the way they are, gives them ammunition to debunk everything that any victim, any child victim of sexual abuse might bring to the public attention down the road. Coming up in A View from the Bunker, Ken Johnson. He has brought a number of ancient texts to the body of Christ, and we appreciate his work. He's soft-spoken, but he's deep, and when he talks, it benefits you to listen. His new book is The Ancient Book of Gad the Seer. Gad was a seer during the days of King David. And so we'll talk about that. You'll hear that on the 18th. On December 25th, a program that I wish wasn't necessary, but we'll repeat the theme of a program from 1 year ago as we wish you a merry non-pagan Christmas. January 1st, haven't decided yet if we're going to post a program. during the period between the holidays, I may take the time to just focus on writing and editing the book. So we're going to see how much time we've got prior to New Year's Day. But guests coming up include Preston Condra, who is a gentleman that we bumped into down at the ARC Encounter. He is a researcher and writer in the field of Christian apologetics. And that's a field that all of us, myself included, need to understand better. Why do we believe what we believe? What's the evidence for the truth claims of Christians? We'll talk to him about that. Sheila Zielinski has a new book out about the power of prayer. We'll talk with her, and you'll hear that interview coming up within the next month or so. And then Ken Giles, a guest on View from the Bunker previously, but not for quite some time. He'll be back. Not to confuse Ken with the relief pitcher for the Houston Astros, different Ken Giles, but those are some of the guests that you'll hear coming up in the weeks ahead on A View from the Bunker, or see if you're watching this on YouTube. And if you're watching on YouTube and you've subscribed to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Derek Gilbert, you'll get a weekly update in the ongoing audiobook novel, a free version of my novel, The God Conspiracy. You'll get it for free every Monday at 9 a.m. Central Time, a new edition. I think we're up to episode 12 or 13, maybe 13 by now. But that's only about halfway through, so you've got time to catch up before we bring it to a conclusion in the spring. And every Sunday, our Bible study, the Gilbert House Fellowship, gilberthouse.org. This weekend, I think we're going to miss because we are going to be out of town unexpectedly. One of Sharon's older sisters passed away a week ago Friday. She had suffered a heart attack about a month ago, and we thought she was recovering, but the Lord had other plans. So we'll be gathering with family, and I don't think have the opportunity to produce the Gilbert House Fellowship this week, but your prayers for the family, Sharon's family especially, much appreciated. But the archives going back to Genesis 1-1 are there at gilberthouse.org, and we encourage you to listen and then participate. We've got a Facebook page for that as well, the Gilbert House Fellowship, just as we do for View from the Bunker, facebook.com/viewfromthebunker. Weigh in on what we discussed here tonight and many other topics. We appreciate you also leaving a review at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you happen to run across this particular podcast. And we remind you that A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House, released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.